Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. On this rather short holiday week, there still is much news. On the positive front, we've gotten word that there is an apparent truce between Israel and Hezbollah, so that the fighting in the north will cease, at least for some period of time. I think credit is due to President Biden, who has been absolutely dogged in his negotiations, despite the difficulty he's had with the Israeli prime minister, despite the difficulty that is posed by terrorist groups and their allies, which include Iran and Russia. And I think if that part of the explosion of violence in the Middle East can be contained and stopped, that's a positive thing. And then, of course, we have to turn to Gaza and hopefully resolve that as well. So that was a piece of good news. The other piece of good news, of course, was Matt Gaetz having to withdraw. And that, once again, shows that we're not going to win them all, but we can win some of them. And it is really important when the characters are really bad to go ahead and do that. The other news that's not quite news, but we're beginning to get some indications, is what Kamala Harris is going to do next. After all, she got 74 plus million votes, one of the highest totals in American history. She was given an impossible task with about 100 days to run in a anti-incumbent atmosphere, which is not only in the United States, but around the world. And she excited a lot of people. She inspired a lot of people. She showed herself to be a very capable candidate. So what does she do now? Well, she hasn't asked for my advice, but I'll give her a few of them anyway. First, there's been talk of her running for governor of California. And I would say this, unless she really wants to be governor and to govern, and potentially then to run for a second term as governor, she shouldn't do it. Because she's going to be able to maintain her profile no matter what. If she's governor of California, she's got to do that job and she's got to stay in there for some period of time. And I will say California is not an easy state to govern. We know that because Gavin Newsom's approval rating is usually under 30%. It's a very difficult, complicated, diverse state with a lot of challenges. So if that's where she wants to go next and she wants to spend a couple of years preparing for that, Gavin Newsom is term limited in 2026, and she's willing to stay in that role for one and probably two terms, then go for it. I think she would be received well. She remains popular. I don't think people blame her for the loss. I think there are a lot of other factors and people, including the president's refusal to bow out earlier on. But she could probably win that, and she could probably do a lot of good, in particular, interposing herself against the Trump administration. But if she's not interested, don't do it. Go do something else. And that something else may be president. So it's too early to say, should she run? But she's going to keep her options open. And what advice can we think of that would allow her to maintain her current popularity, to gain popularity, and to expand her base of support between now and the time that she does have to make a decision, which is probably going to be shortly after the midterms or even 2027? Well, a few things. First of all, she ran as a center-left Democrat, and that worked. She had gone, I think, too far left in 2018, 2019 when she was running. And to some degree, she had to leave a lot of those positions by the wayside. And as she said, she learned from being in office that some of those positions either weren't necessary or weren't a good idea. And she shouldn't revert. She shouldn't move her position. She established herself, I think, in exactly the right place in the political universe. And in part, she did that by stressing a strong national security profile, a strong position on border, and a strong position on crime. And I think Democrats who do that stand a better chance of sustaining a national career than people who don't. So I would certainly urge her to maintain that stance, which is progressive on social issues, pro-business, but progressive on economic issues, and really tough on issues when it comes to national security and defense of the American people. And the other thing I think she needs to do is get to know the rest of the electorate that Democrats had so much difficulty reaching. Everyone has pointed to Hispanic men, and perhaps there is some outreach. But the group that I'm much more concerned about are the people who don't get any news. Those people voted overwhelmingly for Trump. He is the president of the ignorant, the president of the disengaged. And Democrats can't ignore them. I know it's tempting for them to say, how can anyone not know what a policy issue is that's important in a national election? I got news for them. Most people can't name a Supreme Court justice. Most people can't name the three branches of government. We have an epidemic of ignorance. So on one hand, Democrats have to work on making them less ignorant, less disengaged. But I think she really has to use her incredible charisma, her incredible personality, to begin to reach those people who are not political. And that may be going on other media, that may be creating her own media, that may be a role in society in which she interacts much more with people who are not the news people, not the normal people who are the regular primary voters, for example. She's got to expand and improve her ability to permeate the larger electorate to make sure that people really know who she is and know what her values are and know her toughness and her strength. And I think if she does those three things, she makes a smart decision about being governor, she maintains a center-left profile, and she makes headway with people who Democrats had difficulty reaching in this election, then she'll be well positioned in 2026, 2027 to decide if she wants to run for president. The record has not always been great for vice presidents. After all, Joe Biden finally got to be president, but he ran a couple other times. Al Gore didn't get to be president. Walter Mondale didn't get to be president. Democrats can be rather harsh and difficult in moving on. But she impressed a lot of people, and she doesn't have to take herself out of the running. She can be a clarion voice, a clarion call for democracy, for decency, for kindness, for empathy. And I frankly want to see what the next act is. So we'll see what she has to do. Between global warming and rising energy bills, finding the right temperature at night is a struggle we all face. It can make it so hard to fall asleep. But recently, I found a way to sleep in perfect comfort all night long. Whether you sleep too hot or even too cold, my secret is using thermoregulating, NASA-inspired, silver-infused bed sheets by Miracle Made. Their self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding even prevents 99.7% of bacteria, so they stay fresher three times longer. That means three times less laundry, too. Thanks to Miracle Made, you'll stop sleeping on bacteria that can clog your pores and lead to breakouts and acne. They even eliminate bad odors, so your bed always feels freshly made. Life is much more comfortable and clean with Miracle Made. Their temperature-regulating silver-infused fabrics were inspired by NASA to give you maximum comfort, no matter how high the heater is set. Just picture how great it will be to get better sleep every night. Plus, Miracle Sheets feel soft and luxurious without the high price tag of other luxury brands. They even feel nicer than bed sheets used by some 5-star hotels, so you'll feel like you're on vacation every time you get into bed. I imagine I'm in Bermuda or maybe the south of France. So ask yourself, what part of dreamland would Miracle take you to? Miracle has a whole line of comfortable, self-cleaning bedding, pillowcases, and comforters. I know you'll love them. How do you get them? Go to trymiracle.com/greenroom to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo, GreenRoom, at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Remember, go to trymiracle.com/greenroom and use the code GREENROOM to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/greenroom to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. You can look for the link in the show notes. It seems that the rule of law is on shaky grounds these days, doesn't it? The special counsel, Jack Smith, has dismissed without prejudice, meaning he can file again at the end of the Trump presidency, if that ever comes, once more. But he is dismissing both the January 6th case and the espionage case in Florida. What does this mean? It means Donald Trump is not being held accountable for grotesque crimes that, frankly, any other person would be fully prosecuted to the full extent of the law. And why hasn't he been? There are many reasons, but I'll give you two. One is Merrick Garland sat on his duff for too long and pushed the investigation out, pushed the indictment out. And as a result, the second cause, being the Supreme Court, was able to stall until the election. And so we now see the prospect, not only the prospect, but the reality that the guy who instituted a insurrection and who arguably stole classified documents is returning to the White House. Now, isn't that depressing? Well, I still think there is something called the rule of law, and it's going to be very interesting to see what part of it holds up after a few more years of Trump. But when I am either confused about the state of the law or despondent about the state of the law, there are a handful of legal minds that I turn to. And one of them is Mimi Roja. She is a former federal prosecutor. She is currently the district attorney of Westchester County in New York. And she is invariably on the money and I think mixes a savvy appreciation for how the law works with some really wonderful insights about the state of democracy and some practical things that perhaps lawyers can do during this time. So I thought this was a perfect time to talk to Mimi, and I am so glad she's with us. Welcome to the show, Mimi.
Thanks, Jen. It's great to be with you.
Oh, it is so much fun to have you on the program. Full disclosure, Mimi and I are friends. I'm a great admirer of her work. So
mutual admiration.
Very nice, very nice. So we have you on just 24, 48 hours or so after Jack Smith has voluntarily dismissed the two federal cases. Tell us why you think that was necessary, if you do think it was necessary, and how we kind of got to this spot where we're going to return to the Oval Office, the guy who instituted an insurrection and at least is alleged to have taken some of our nation's top secrets, stashed them in his resort bathroom, and he's going to be returning to the Oval Office. So let's start with the Jack Smith part first.
Okay.
Why did he dismiss, and did he have to?
So I think that the answer to your first question, and I know you've talked a lot about this at various points, of, you know, did Jack Smith need to dismiss the cases, and what was the right thing for him to do?
Right.
I'll start by saying I hate second guessing prosecutors. Being a prosecutor in
exactly.
a position, it's very easy for us to say what we think should have happened. We don't know all of the factors. But what we do know is that Jack Smith said in his motion to dismiss them that he's abiding by an opinion given to him by the Office of Legal Counsel, or OLC, because there had never been exactly this case opined upon before. There have been similar ones, but not this. And that OLC's opinion that was given to him was this would be unconstitutional to go forward against a sitting president, even though the indictment occurred beforehand. And once he was given that opinion, I think, you know, Jack Smith's hands were quite tied, in that he is not the kind of person who's going to say, well, I don't agree with that. Yeah. Did he have to go to OLC to begin with is another question. Could he have said, well, there's no OLC opinion right now saying that you cannot proceed with an already indicted, filed indictment against a sitting president. And by the way, that's an opinion, not a law, not a rule. It's an interpretation of what past OLCs have thought about the Constitution, as you well know, but it is not binding. I think he could have done that. Certainly there would have been some pushback, loud pushback from Republicans, but, you know, and this gets to a broader question about who's following the norms and who isn't,
right,
which I'm sure we will talk more about.
Yes, yes. Let me just stop you on that part. Could Jack Smith have made the decision to go to OLC or not gone to OLC without the intervention of the Attorney General Merrick Garland? Or would this be the sort of thing that they would have to agree upon?
I don't know enough about the special counsel regulations to say whether he had to. I don't think so. I mean, again, I think as a matter of course, on a big decision like this, anybody in the Department of Justice, whether in whatever role, unless prohibited from going to the Attorney General, would, in part because it's a big, important decision that the Attorney General should have a say in, but in part because it's a little bit of, I don't want to say, I don't think Jack Smith is one to run away from big decisions, but it's not only, he probably felt it was not only his decision to
right.
make.
Right. So if he had not gone to OLC and had not obtained this opinion, and then dismissed because, in essence, it would be futile to go forward because in however many days Donald Trump is going to be sworn in. If he hadn't done that, he would have forced Trump to fire him and possibly fire his whole office. Would there be utility in terms of just forcing Trump to take that? Or frankly, would that have kind of reinforced their abandonment of norms? Which would you rather see, that Jack Smith kind of do it himself, or you'd rather see Donald Trump forced to do it himself?
I understand not wanting to be fired. And I think there's plus and minuses for everybody, no matter what course was taken. But at the end of the day, I would have preferred, all things being equal, that Trump was forced to fire him, to own this outcome, in
yes.
large part because, you know, Trump is going to spin it no matter what in his favor, as are many of his supporters, allies, whatever you want to call them. But it would have made it harder for him to argue the most disingenuous and dangerous thing that he's arguing, which is this is exoneration, vindication, you know, which has been said so many times. And any rational person, you don't have to be a lawyer to know this is not exoneration or vindication on the merits. And Jack Smith said that, and dismissals happen all the time for reasons having nothing to do with the merits. But if he had had to fire him and then dismiss, order the cases to be dismissed, it would have at least a little bit prevented that argument from being made so forcefully. So I guess at the end of the day, again, I said I wasn't going to second guess, but
that's why you're here.
If I had my dream world here in the world of nightmares, right, I would take that.
So how do you apportion responsibility for this outcome? How much of this outcome was Jack Smith? How much was the Supreme Court in handing this Swiss cheese, you know, sort of puzzle back down to the lower court? How much of it was Merrick Garland for kind of, frankly, screwing around for 18 months on this theory he was going to go from the bottom up when everyone knew he could have done a relatively brief investigation up front and perhaps in 2021 indicted Trump? Where do you see the lion's share of the responsibility here?
So, I mean, you and I have, and others have talked about this a bunch, and I think there's very valid arguments to be made all around on this issue of who to be outraged at or upset with. But I do want to come back to, ultimately, it really lies with Donald Trump and his enablers. I mean, I know that's not your question, but I can't answer the question without saying that. Yep. Because at every step, they successfully and were helped along maybe, but did seek to delay and take positions that nobody else would have even tried to take because it clearly violated the law or norms or traditions. So I feel like we need to leave responsibility there first. Sure. And foremost. Sure. However, there were decisions made along the way that certainly helped us get to this point. The reason I do not sort of blame Merrick Garland in the way that I think many other people do is not because I don't think there was a delay that he could have chosen not to take, but more because Garland was picked to be Attorney General because of who he is and who he has been his whole life, which is someone who is very much a traditionalist and an institutionalist and respecting norms and rules. And so he was not going to be the person to come in and say, let's take on this aggressive, not aggressive, but this challenging investigation of the former president in this charged atmosphere. Ultimately that comes down to Biden and his advisors.
Exactly.
But again, President Biden was elected in that term on restoring civility and all of this. Now, maybe all of this now seems incredibly naive and bad. Yep. Decisions. But again, if we go back to that time, nobody was making bad faith decisions. I think they were trying. Yep. To get the country back to a place that, frankly, I don't know if we can get back to. And that's really the problem. But these actors were the right people to try and get us there, including Merrick Garland. And so I think he thought, you know, I'll do the rest of the case that we think, or he thought, was non-controversial. Turns out, you know, maybe that's not even the case because we have a now president-elect who's talking about pardoning those people, but in the January 6th case, but cases. So I guess I'm explaining a little bit more where I don't lay blame in it. Right. It is an emotional response, perfectly valid to say I'm mad at this person, and our leaders and institutions are responsible for their actions. But, you know, I think it takes a little bit of responsibility off the American public.
Yes.
And what we were looking for at the time.
And what they just did, they elected him. They yeah. knew what he had done, and they said, yeah, that's the guy for us. And right. I think we have a serious problem that they may not have endorsed it, but it doesn't bother them that they're willing to have a president who did this. Now, obviously, there's also the Supreme Court in there, and it's not just their opinion in the immunity case, but a whole series of precedent-breaking partisan issues plus the ethics issues. Is the Supreme Court broken permanently? How could we ever restore it to what it was, which is kind of this respected body that you assume good faith, that you assume they're trying to find the answer or an answer? How do we ever get that back?
I don't know if we can with this makeup of the Supreme Court. I think that, you know, Chief Justice Roberts had the last shred of credibility, maybe, on sort of that side of the fence, in that people thought that he would protect the institution, but allowing, I think, first and foremost, the two things. One, the blatant ethical violations to be staring us in the face and not even seemingly attempting to do anything about them, even minor ramifications, is appalling and makes people lose faith. And then second, you know, and I think this is debated still amongst even some smart legal scholars, but I just think that the immunity decision was incredibly result oriented. When I read it, that was what I kept thinking. Okay, they had the result they knew they wanted to get at. So while I think it's sort of irredeemable at this point, you know, I do think that if there were a series of decisions where it seemed like they were not being so results oriented in favor of the person not necessarily the person, but the framework of the presidency that they seem to want to support, of this enormous executive power, that would help. But it's going to take more than one opinion/decision. Can I just go back for one second, because I forgot to say something on your last question about the blame and responsibility?
Absolutely.
I do think it's worth mentioning that Jack Smith actually, again, not perfect by any means, but boy, I mean, he did try under the time frame that he had to get this case through, to the point that there were other legal commentators criticizing him and saying, oh, he's trying to influence the election. And at the time I said, well, it's not so much about influencing the election as it is about getting this done before the election, because if Trump is elected, this will there will never be accountability.
Exactly.
And, you know, here we are. But I think he deserves sort of a shout out for trying to beat the clock, so to speak.
And in considering how long cases take, the fact that a case of this magnitude, he did as quickly as he did, and with as much evidence as he apparently gathered, is pretty remarkable. Definitely. Now, are we going to get a special counsel report? And if so, what utility, either in the short term or the long term, do you think that would have?
I think we will get a report. I mean, as I understand, and if I remember back from the Mueller report, he has to give it to the Attorney General. The Attorney General can give it to Congress if there is something in it that he disagrees with, if I recall. But I think an unredacted copy can be made public. I mean, the problem was with Bill Barr when he was the Attorney General that he redacted and he obfuscated so much. Given everything we're saying here, I don't think Garland will do any of that. To the extent he makes it public, it will be as transparent and on its face what it is. I hesitate to get people's hopes up about that. I think there's been so many hopes gotten up and dashed along the years about, you know, what accountability DOJ can provide. I'm not saying would be nothing in there that we don't already know, but I think we know, as you've said, the broad outlines of the evidence. I don't even know that a criminal conviction would have made a difference for that reason. But again, we don't know what we don't know. So we don't know what other evidence the special counsel has.
Now, what about the other people who were involved? They were unindicted co-conspirators in the federal case. There were other defendants in the Florida case. What happens to them? Why not pursue them and make Trump pardon them?
Well, I mean, I think now it's too late for that. In a normal Department of Justice,
yes.
Yes. Even with, you know, the Republican or the person who was a target of the investigation coming in, you still could possibly have independent U.S. attorneys pursuing cases against the unindicted co-conspirators. I think there is almost zero chance of that happening in the soon-to-be Trump Justice Department, obviously, because he will have too much control over it. So there won't even be attempts at that. And that's a problem. But and I don't think that there would be state cases to make, because I think really all of the conduct, chargeable conduct, would be in Washington, D.C. So locale-wise, I think there would be a problem outside of a Washington prosecutor. And there isn't really a Washington district attorney that's completely independent from the U.S. attorney. And I think that it's hard to even think of what state crimes there could be, depending on which state we're talking about. But
right.
So I don't know that anything happens to them other than possible civil suits by victims.
There are still pending civil suits on January 6th against Trump and others.
Yeah. And those are important. I mean, you know, this is where we get into the sort of what are the limits of criminal law, not just because of all the machinations that have gone on, but in general, criminal law is more narrow than civil law, as it should be, right? In general, we want our criminal laws not to be so sweeping. Civil law does provide more opportunities for accountability.
And in the same way that E. Jean Carroll got accountability in civil suits, he wasn't criminally prosecuted for what the judge, I think, correctly labeled in sort of layman's terms, a rape. He wasn't criminally prosecuted, but he had two hefty judgments that were levied against him. So let's get into this issue about norms and the rule of law. It seems that Democrats really did try to play it straight in the Biden years. After all, they indicted and prosecuted and convicted Robert Menendez. They indicted and are still pursuing Hunter Biden. They followed every judge's order. They made arguments that were within the four corners of the law on Trump. And yet the other side does not seem bound by these niceties. And moreover, has declared war on the system itself. In other words, after there was a conviction in New York, Trump and his cronies have gone after the jury, the judge, the entire structure. So how do we operate? And this is partly a legal question, partly a political question, when one side is playing by the rules and the other side just isn't. Do Democrats have to start playing fast and loose? Do they have to stick to their guns? What do you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think politically and sort of ethically, this is a really hard question, especially for someone like me who was brought up in the Department of Justice with all these norms and rules being abided by, not just by Democrats. I mean, I think that's when you say that the Biden administration was, you know, maybe to a fault doing that. And, you know, doing the justice without fear or favor, we will prosecute. I mean, Damian Williams, the U.S. attorney in Southern District of New York, you know, brought an indictment against two prominent Democrats, Menendez, Mayor Adams. But that's in a long tradition, right? I saw a list recently, actually, because I was trying to look this up, of how many Democrats and how many Republicans have been prosecuted over the years, sort of nationally, if you look at all the mostly high profile cases. And it was quite even, actually. You know, and we're talking about different jurisdictions, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, you know, there and all different kinds of crimes, though mostly corruption related. And I think the real so I think if we're talking about that issue of are we going to have a Justice Department that doesn't prosecute based on someone's political affiliation, but rather on the conduct that they committed. And it doesn't matter if I was appointed by a Democrat or a Republican, I will pursue that case with equal energy, you know, regardless. if we're talking about that question, we have to continue to abide by that, I think, as Democrats, and we have to fight as hard as we can to find ways to force the Trump Justice Department to abide by that as well. Because, and I realize I have a bias, I'm a prosecutor, but to me that is one of the most absolutely dangerous things we could see happen, of the power of the criminal law being enforced against one group of people because of their political affiliation versus another. I mean, we're just in such a dark territory then of every sort of dictatorship, you know, that we've known. And again, I can say from personal experience, I was in the Southern District when cases would come across our desk, so to speak, whether it was a Democrat or a Republican, and whether the U.S. attorney was appointed by a Democrat or a Republican president, it did not matter. Nobody talked about that. And I mean, even elected officials that some of us liked, like, it just did not matter.
Right.
I have talked publicly about not prosecuting Trump for fraud here in Westchester. And, you know, I'm pretty obviously I'm not a Trump fan or supporter, but I followed the law and the facts and what evidence we had. So I think if I'm going to single out that one as one that we can't stop fighting for. But I think that's different than some of the political norms and even DOJ norms about, you know, with the political norms. We just saw one example about the ethics report about Matt Gaetz, and you have the head of the ethics committee, the Republican, saying, you know, nope, he's gone now. So, you know, we don't release those. Under what law? No, it's not a law. It's, I guess, a norm or a, you know, sort of tradition. But that's something that I think easily we should be pushing really hard on, because that doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
And goes in line with a lot of the other norms that Republicans seem very, Trump supporters in particular, seem very willing to throw by the wayside.
Right. One of the other norms that we used to have is Congress didn't meddle with state and local prosecutors. There's federalism, they really don't have jurisdiction. But of course, Republicans tried to do that. I don't know how many times they tried to subpoena or call in both the Fulton County prosecutor and Alvin Bragg in New York. Should Democrats be equally willing to bring in local prosecutors if those people start going after members of the Biden administration, or should that be another red line that they don't pursue?
I think that in general, it's a dangerous path to go down. Obviously, I was opposed to it and spoke about it when it happened to the DA in Manhattan and in Georgia. But I think it does depend a little bit on the facts. I mean, part of why I say that is, look, both of them had cases that had indictments returned by grand juries.
Right.
That
Which
is
different. Ordinary people. Ordinary
exactly.
people.
And so that alone should provide some degree of sort of, okay, we're talking about a pending criminal indictment that went through the normal process. I think if there's a state prosecutor who is not, it is all about process, and who is on a fishing expedition that is so blatantly, I mean, it's going to require a very extraordinary set of circumstances that I wouldn't say it's a bad idea for even congressional Democrats to go down the road, but I think it could exist, right? And you know, I think particularly when criminal cases look, smell, sound like, if it walks like a dog, it is a dog, or whatever that saying is, retribution, then I think Democrats need to really, you know, think hard about not sticking by past practices in that sense.
Right.
But again, I would reserve that for very narrow circumstances, because I do think it's a dangerous path that I know Republicans have gone down, but even for them, they only went down it in certain cases, and it didn't stop the prosecutions, though other things did.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
So there are some other circumstances, and I think, see if you agree that these are things that Democrats should start doing. Republicans are not ashamed to make all kinds of arguments that we thought were almost ridiculous. Perhaps Democrats should be more creative in their arguing. Another norm would be running to judge shopping. They have gone to Amarillo, Texas, I don't know how many times. Should Democrats be doing the same thing, finding, you know, somebody in the Ninth Circuit or someplace else? What about those kinds of norms? And can you think of others where Democrats should loosen up a little bit, frankly, in order, and after all, what we're talking about is potentially protecting innocent people from a deportation, innocent people from very severe consequences, or enforcing, you know, environmental laws, things that have real world consequences. What about those two situations or other situations where Democrats might kind of rethink their restraint?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we're talking about sort of the intersection of politics and law.
Yes.
And I still am going to try to keep them separate a little bit, in the sense that if we're talking about, and we can talk about this separately in a minute, but people in DOJ, so I'm not labeling them Democrats, because I have no idea who's a Democrat and who's a Republican, or if they are anything. Those people, and sort of what norms they should be expecting from a Justice Department and follow, versus if we're talking about people who are defending, say, someone from the special counsel team who, you know, the Trump Justice Department decides to pursue. If you're a lawyer defending them, which I'm sure there would be many who would step up, I think you use, first of all, then you're in the position of a defense lawyer or you know, a civil lawyer, and you want to do everything you can for your client in that context. I think that, you know, in the political arena, you know, I mean, I think it's very nice that there are norms that, and there certainly are rules to govern Congress, but a lot of them are out the door on the Republican side. And I think we have to level the playing field somewhat. I'm not saying that we should just decide, well, it's war. But I think, and when I say we, I don't mean Democrats and Republicans, though I know it's shorthand for us to say that. But it's really, in my mind, people who want to protect and support, you know, the Constitution and democracy, and the people who don't. And, you know, there are some, I mean, as you know, and we know well, you know, Republicans who do fall in that category.
Right. And I think there are going to be some strange bedfellows. We have heard Rand Paul, of all people, returning to his libertarian roots and saying, no, you cannot use the military to go rounding up people. So I think we should not be too picky about allies, considering who the intended targets and victims are, which are people who are relatively defenseless.
The question about which norms do we protect and which don't we, or try to protect or try to preserve, also depends on what someone is trying to do. I mean, if we're talking about using the military against civilians, forget norms. Like, that's you know, the house is literally on fire and it's an emergency. So I do tend to look at things not as categorically, but very fact specific.
Very good point. So the lawyers who are not going to be swept out, not the political appointees, the people who, career prosecutors, career DOJ people, should they stay? Should they go? If they go, should they go now? Or should they wait for some outrage so they can go out with a bang and call the public attention to you? What would you say, or what are you saying to people who are at DOJ?
I think this is such a hard question. And my heart literally goes out to the people who are dealing with this and thinking about this in real time. Because I think that up until now, and even during the first Trump administration, there was a belief that you could be in the Department of Justice, you know where your line is, right? And we saw examples of this in the first administration of people who would not sign certain briefs or make certain arguments, even some who did resign publicly in order to draw attention to it. But they also weren't, I think, sort of fearing retaliation in the way that people now legitimately have to. I mean, you can't call someone paranoid to think about that. That if I stay and I know where my line is and I refuse to do something, what consequence might I receive for that? And I just don't know the answer to that. I mean, I really don't. I can think of a worst case scenario. I can think of a best case scenario, you know, and there've been people in institutions, including DOJ, not just in the first Trump administration, but over the years who have had their, you know, things they would and wouldn't enforce. I mean, when I was a prosecutor in the Southern District in the early 2000s under, you know, after 2001, under the Bush second term, and even, you know, before the second term, there were a lot of things that I look back on now that, you know, I don't agree with. Does that mean I would have resigned over them? I don't know. I wasn't that same person then.
Yeah.
But people, for the most part, understood that there were going to be policy differences, right?
Yes.
I might not agree with the way that a certain policy on immigration enforcement or drug enforcement is, you know, being dictated by certain administrations. And that could be both ways. I mean, you could have people who are line prosecutors who say, well, I think you're being too lax, or I think you're being too strict. But it was never so extreme that people thought, I need to leave because of this. I mean, it maybe happened occasionally, but rarely. I think the problem is now, are we going to see this on a more mass scale?
Yep.
And so, I mean, I do worry about mass resignations, not because people are opposed to a political agenda, but because they're being asked to do cases that they simply do not feel they can support. But then who's going to replace them, right? Who's, the people who are hired to replace them by this administration are probably going to be given some kind of litmus test, which is, again, something that's never been done before.
Right.
So it's a really hard question. I really do worry for people in the Department of Justice. I think a lot of them are taking some comfort from the idea that Todd Blanche presumably will be the deputy attorney general and Emile Bove will be the primary, the PDAG. I can't think of what the exact title is right now. But you know, they are career prosecutors. I know Todd. I don't know Emile there at all, really, other than where he came from. I know Todd very well. We work together closely. And so what I can say about someone like Todd is I wouldn't sit here and vouch for him because I wouldn't do that for anybody who works near, around, or for Trump. But I do know him well enough to know what he was taught about the Department of Justice and what's appropriate and not appropriate, and that he believed in those things.
Right.
I think he still believes in those things, but, and I know that he's a good person, but, you know, we'll see if that can hold up in this environment. But I think that there are people who breathed a sigh of relief that it's not going to be Matt Gaetz as their attorney general, and that there is someone like Todd who will be in a position between the Trump administration, meaning in the White House, and the DOJ employees. But it will also depend who they pick, you know, for criminal division chief and things like that.
So, and just for the audience, Todd Blanche was Donald Trump's personal attorney in these criminal cases and other matters. And
can I just say why that doesn't bother me as yes. much as I think yes. some people? Because I do think that lawyers wear different hats all the time. I was critical of Todd, not of taking on Trump on as a client, because I think defense lawyers take on all sorts of people as clients. But I did at one point say, I'm not, you know, I don't like that he's standing there while Trump is telling what seemed to me to be blatant lies. And he's not, he's sort of owning them and giving credibility to that. But that said, lawyers wear different hats all the time. Right. It is so common to go back and forth in these worlds. And I just think how someone acts as a defense attorney, a criminal defense attorney, is not, should not be the be all to end all sort of view of how they will be when they're put in a role in an institution that, again, I know they were taught, you know, how it should perform and function. I think he will need to be asked serious questions and, you know, hopefully get serious answers about the difference between those roles. But I know he understands the difference. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
And I think putting on the commentator's hat or the former DOJ hat, you can write to those people. I don't mean write a letter to them. I mean, you make arguments in the public square to remind them, to urge them, to prick their conscience to see if they will be moved. Now, maybe he's not. Maybe he's drunk the Kool-Aid at this point and figures, you know, he's all in. But we're going to find out. Let's talk for a minute about the Attorney General nominee. You wrote a very powerful op-ed with others about what it meant to have Matt Gaetz nominated for Attorney General. For those in the audience who didn't get a chance to read that, and we'll put it in the show notes, why was that so beyond the pale for you to see Matt Gaetz potentially become an Attorney General?
Really for two reasons. One, you know, unlike the people we were just talking about, he has zero experience. I mean, first and foremost, this is a management job of an enormous institution with the primary responsibility is actually to bring cases and keep the public safe. Drug cases, gang cases, sex crimes cases, child exploitation cases, pornography cases. I mean, things that regardless of your political stripe, I'm going to say most people care about, right? And so that I think in and of itself, you know, it particularly with the Justice Department is just disqualifying. But it's not only that, it is also that there are these very credible, I don't even want to call them allegations, things in the public record, because it's beyond allegations.
Yes.
I mean, we
yes.
have more than, it's not about whether he was criminally prosecuted, which I know, you know, drives a lot of us crazy when people say, well, they didn't bring a case, DOJ dropped the case, or that is not the standard here. The standard
Correct.
Here is what do we know about his character and what we know. Even if you take the one example that Republican senators talked about, or you know, colleagues of his, people who in the Congress who said that he was showing them videos, sex videos of him having and bragging about, you know, having sex with these young women. That in and of itself, for a position like this, where you need victims to come forward and trust that they're going to have their claims fairly evaluated. And now you have Matt Gaetz, you know, sort of parading this around and discrediting the people who did come under oath and apparently accuse him of things by saying that, you know, they're liars. I mean, you can't credibly have that person leading the institution that is responsible for that level of law enforcement and safety. You just, it would bring it to a halt, really, I think.
Right.
So those are the two. I could come up with others, but those
right,
are
right.
primary disqualifying reasons.
Right. And to be clear, it was Republicans, a critical number of Republicans who said, we are not going to vote for this guy that forced Trump's hand. This Democrats are powerless. They're not going to have a majority. They're not going to have the votes. So it really is up to Republicans.
And that was frightening. I mean,
it was. It absolutely was.
But you know, it showed that there are at least little itsy bitsy guardrails.
Correct, correct.
And I think the people in the Department of Justice did breathe a sigh of relief. Whether that was premature, I don't know, but it I think did bring some relief.
Got it. I want to talk about one more guardrail and a little bit of hope, and that is this issue of background checks. Are you going to have an FBI background check for all the nominees? And are you going to have background checks for the people in the White House who have access to classified information? The Trump people seem dangerously bent on ignoring those. And as to the first category, which is people who must be confirmed by the Senate, as opposed to people who are working in the White House who are not subject to confirmation, we did hear from a few Republicans. We heard from Susan Collins. We heard from Lisa Murkowski. We heard even from Kevin Cramer. And these people said, we really do need background checks on these people. And, you know, what are they going to find if they do a background check on Tulsi Gabbard? What does her FBI file look like? What can you say about background checks and how extraordinary it would be to miss that step for either category, either the nominees who are facing confirmation or the White House people who don't get confirmed but may have access to really sensitive, the most sensitive information we have?
Going back to where we were, what we were discussing about norms, this is one of those areas where we cannot, Democrats should not let this go. And frankly, Republicans shouldn't either. Right. And I think that it's important with respect to both the nominees and the non-nominees. But I actually think it's probably even more important for the ones who will not have Senate confirmation hearings.
Right, right.
Because there's really no check on them whatsoever.
Right.
And the people working in these spaces have so much power and access in a way that to leave it just completely unchecked seems very dangerous to me.
So as we reach the end of our time, let me ask a very generic question, which is, what can other people do to hold the line? Is it going to be up to judges to tell these prosecutors that's a frivolous argument, you're not going to make it, or I'm going to sanction you? Is it going to be up to governors to try to intercede or raise state law claims? What is the universe of people that you would look to help in what is going to be a traumatic period of time to help at least prevent the worst of the worst?
So, I mean, this is the question I think everybody is trying to figure out, including myself. You know, where do we go from here? What do we do to make sure that what is the most effective way to try and protect our institutions and our democracy, I think is really the question. So I think one thing it's not is, and you know, is I did this as well, but is being reacting to every single thing, because we just can't, right? And we have to save our strength and the public strength for the things that really matter, which I know you've been trying to do. And even in this conversation, we've been trying to do. Here's one that really matters. Here's one where it depends on the facts. Here's one where, you know, maybe it's not as important. I think, again, was so heartened by the Matt Gaetz situation, let's call it, because it showed that there are some Republicans who, whether it's because they didn't like him personally, they really didn't think this crossed such a line, or because they don't want the power of the Senate being, you know, eradicated, right? They were worried that even if they let this go forward and didn't say anything now, that Trump was going to try to get him in some way without the hearings, the whole recess appointment thing. And so it was better to say up front, I'm not going to support you. And then, you know, ideally, which happened, he would withdraw. So I think making arguments that appeal to those Republican senators that have this interest in maintaining these institutions is super important, and who, I don't know the best way to do that, but I think they are an audience for sure, yep. if not the key audience. I think lawyers reminding judges who will be deciding many of these cases throughout yep. the next 4 years over and over of their responsibilities and oaths. I mean, I do believe that judges, no matter who they're appointed by, I used to think this 100%, that it didn't matter who you were appointed by. And judges really, for the most part, did try to follow, you know, the facts and the law. I'm not as sure of that anymore, but I still think overall we have to believe in that and again, push on it, right? So that's yes. going to be where the legal community is going to be very important. I think organizations like, you know, bar associations yep. and lawyers groups are going to really need to support lawyers who do feel that they're being retaliated against at DOJ. I know people, you know, trying to figure that out. And you know, I think there will be a lot of people stepping up to do that. It's not going to be one thing, right? It's right. going to be many small things. It's going to be pacing and giving credit where credit's due. If there are things, I don't believe that we just say everything is horrible. I'm not one of those people. I think we have to pick and choose the things that truly are horrible and things that we can let go, and maybe even things that we can compliment or praise. Right. You know, otherwise we lose credibility.
And the other thing that I would add is that we do have a federal system, and there will be times where the states can interpose themselves. There was a whole lot of litigation in the first Trump term by states' attorneys general, governors who brought issues, got issues to the courts. Now, the Supreme Court has moved the goalposts on some of that litigation, environmental litigation, but where possible, they did. And I think the public, the voters, can put pressure on them as well. This is all a little disheartening, isn't it? And we didn't think we were going to be here. Let's end on this note. What gives you hope?
Boy, I haven't had to actually answer that question since November 7th. I think what gives me hope is many of the things we've been talking about. It is institutions that I still do believe in, and I don't think they'll just flourish and survive on their own, but I think there are enough people who are going to be trying to support and protect them. I plan to be one of those people. I know you're one of those people. I mean, journalism is a whole other category of fear that to talk about. And, you know, I've seen my own kids be really engaged, frankly, yep. throughout the election and after, unlike, you know, I think the weary adults,
right.
for many teenagers and people in college, it's the first time that they're really consciously experiencing this, and it is engaging them rather than disengaging them. I don't want to do the whole, you know, the future, you know, will be saved by young kids, because that's not fair to put that on them. But it is interesting to me that many of them have never known a world without Donald Trump, a political world. And so I think, but yet they know there's something not normal about this, right. and are nervous, about a lot of the issues we're nervous about, but other ones too. I mean, mainly I would say environment and, you know, gun issues. I mean, not that I don't care about those, but they're not ones we've talked about today. And I think that them realizing it would be nice to have a world where this was not the new normal would be, is now dawning on them that they're going to have to really fight for that.
Fair enough. Amy, thank you so much for coming on. It's absolutely been fun and a pleasure. And we all wish you well in your continuing professional duties and everything else that you do. So thank you for playing the role that you have been, which I think is vitally important. I think current prosecutors, former prosecutors have unique insight into what is going on, and they can perhaps speak to those people in the Justice Department with a level of authority that is received. So thank you so much, and we'll have you back on the show.
Thank you, Jen, and thanks for all you do.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
And that was Mimi Rocha. I think she embodies the best of prosecutors and the best of lawyers, which is a conscious awareness of the dangers, the lines that have been crossed, the norms that have been broken, with a proper amount of expectation and even optimism that there are still people who are willing to do the right thing. Now, the balance between those two may have shifted over the years. There may be fewer people willing to hold the line. We do have Trump judges like Judge Eileen Cannon who cannot be trusted to do the right thing. But that doesn't mean there aren't some people. And what I have tried to communicate to the general public, to people who are going to be in government during the Trump administration, is you cannot save the world every single time. What you can do is you can do some good when you can. And that doesn't sound like much, but it's better than nothing. And that means an individual prosecutor can argue back to his supervisor. It means that interest groups can file amicus briefs to raise the red flag. It means bar association groups can speak up when there's a threat of retaliation. There are things that can be done, and it's up to all of us to do them. It's not an excuse to say, I'm not going to win them all, or they're going to win so many battles. Yes, because they won an election, and that's a whole different problem. But even when they have won an election, at least for now, we still have a constitution, we still have courts. And as I said to Mimi, it is really important what governors, local officials do. They have a tremendous amount of power and authority. Trump does not have the manpower to conduct a deportation of 11 million people. He does not have the singular authority to retaliate against individuals. There are people all the way down the line, whether it's prosecutors, judges, governors, who have a responsibility and who have some power in this system. And I am somewhat heartened by Democratic governors who have stepped up. Governor Newsom from California. We've heard from J.B. Pritzker and others who, in particular on the deportation issue, have said, no, you don't. We're going to defend our people. We're not going to participate in these kinds of dragnet actions. Now, there are all kinds of legal issues about whether they have the right to do so, whether Trump can retaliate, but it's important that they speak up. That's what you want. You cannot, as Timothy Snyder said, obey in advance. You cannot let them get so far with no objection whatsoever. It's important to take down a Matt Gaetz, even if you aren't going to get many others or even any others. It's important to make the try, and it's important to leave a record. And we're in for a world of hurt. I know that. I'm not unrealistic. But I also think, as in any dark time, there will be people who stand out, who are admirable, who serve as role models, who serve as inspiration. And I think for those people, the rest of us can lift them up, can point to them, can reward them with our praise and our support. And that's how we're going to get through this. It's not going to be easy, but we will. So I do want to hear from you. If you work in government, I really want to hear from you, whether you're going to stay, whether you're not going to stay. So make sure you leave some comments. And I do want to hear how you're holding up under the circumstances. So a happy, happy Thanksgiving to all of you. I hope it's joyful. I hope it's delicious. And refuel, get ready. It's going to be a long 4 years. So thanks so much. And if you like this program, you like our other programs, tell your friends. They can follow us wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.